This is the Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs meeting here in Room A at 1 o'clock p.m. on Wednesday, May 11, 1977.
Bill 474. That's the fair share. You going to work out today?
Yeah.
Yeah, we got a quorum.
I got to get a speech at 6:30.
You want to take action on this?
It's a hard time. We're working out with you guys.
Is that then enough?
Yeah. You work me too hard. We're going to work slow. I still work too hard.
You're going to get back
to thinking. Chairman, amendments were adopted on 425-77 and passed out.
I think so. I think the one is April 25th. April 25th. We had a hearing on this April 25th.
Who? It's been OEA's proposed amendments.
OEA proposed amendments.
I'll move the amendment. We've adopted it.
We've adopted the amendments already, Senator.
Okay, I'll move it out.
Senator Carson moves 474 to the floor as amended. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Roberts? Senator Trow?
Aye.
Senator Wyers?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Senator Trow, that's a bill to do with education. Would you
like to carry that?
Okay. Okay, let's go to 1049. Senate Bill 1049. The amendment that I have offered is to increase permanent partial disability, the scheduled from $70 a grade, $85 a grade. I think we have the cost for this would be a 3.68% increase in the cost of workers' comp. We go to 90, it'd be 4.72. To $100 would be 7.37. Where did this information from?
This information comes from Mike Lamb. It's apparently a directly proportionate increase. You could take any fraction of the $30 increase and figure from the 7.37% increase figure. In other words, 85, which is half of the $30 increase, would be half of the 7.37 or 3.68. Where is the medical?
Well, it's in the bill. Well, these amendments took those out. That's right.
Yeah.
The total
right.
I might mention that the amendments do several things. It does increase the permanent partial award to $85 for each degree. It deletes the $100 from line 11 of page 2 of the printed bill and substitutes 85. It also restores the schedule on pages 2 and 3. Deletes on page 4 deletes all of page 4, which are the portion which relates to the American Medical Association guides to evaluate permanent impairment. In other words, what we would be doing is going back to the current statutory scheme with an increase from $70 to $85 a degree. In addition, it amends the section of ORS that deals with the second injury award, section 656-622. It adds a new subsection 3 on page 2 of the amendments. In order to authorize the board to spend funds from the Second Injury Fund to reimburse employers for a certain term and a certain amount of a employee's wages when they hire that employee after he has had one injury already that a claim has been made against. The intent that was worked out in the subcommittee was to encourage employers to hire persons who have already incurred an injury that was compensable. The present system, many employers contend that they simply can't take the risk of being hit with a second injury claim. This would be a front-end sort of program instead of a back-end sort of program that we have now. It would be an active encouragement by reimbursing employers to some degree for some length of time as determined by the board by rule for hiring an employee who had been injured previously.
I'd say the reason for that amendment is I met with some of the medical societies, and most recently the Multnomah County Medical Society, and they said one of the problems they have is if a man has a back injury, that they're reluctant to hire him, the employer. They have one doctor related to one of his patients that was playing tennis, and yet they wouldn't hire him because he had a back injury. And we feel that we could save the system a great deal of money if we can get these people back to work. And I think this money on the front end would accomplish this if the employer wouldn't face the liability that he now does through this amendment. I think would save, in the long run, would save a great deal for the system.
Also, the amendments delete the compensation for the amount of actual loss of wages, and also the sections dealing with the providing of income information to the Workman's Comp Board, which would not be needed in this section because we are deleting, or the amendments would delete any compensation for actual wage loss. So we have the current system with an increased $85 degree and a new second injury program, which the amendments would accomplish.
What I would like to do here today, and I would like to adopt these amendments and have them engrossed, and another hearing on this bill. In fact, I believe can have another hearing at a later date.
I move the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Troll moves the amendment, adopts the amendment. Senator Carson?
Two questions. One relating, we have a document titled Keith Wilson has given us, dated May 11th, 77. He speaks, I think, to the second injury area. Has Richard, I could ask Richard or I could ask Keith, he's sitting out here, but has new amendment, does our amendment that Senator Troll just moved reflect the concerns raised by Mr. Wilson? Maybe not. I'll support Senator Troll's motion, Mr. Chairman, but at some point we're going to bite the bullet on this, and I wonder if maybe before
the next meeting, before we have another hearing of this bill, I would like to meet with Keith Wilson and see if we can't come up with a proper amendment that would accomplish that. I think the suggestions are good.
So do I.
And I'd be willing to.
Do you want to do that now, or do you want to get the bill reprinted and then do it?
Well, we might have to have a... Let's wait and let's see if we can have it, probably at our next meeting, have it engrossed, because there will be further amendments. Do you have the amendments drafted yet, Keith?
No, I don't.
I think we should meet with him, probably Senator Carson,
tell me when you want.
Would you be willing to meet with Keith and whoever Keith wants from the board and see if we can't have the amendments? And perhaps Bob Kennedy and someone from management would like to meet Jack Kalinowski.
Then will we have a fiscal impact on $75?
Well, I hope the Workers' Compensation Board can give us a fiscal impact, and I presume they can. Okay. Do you have any?
I want to ask Richard a question.
Richard?
About the amendments. I understand what it does to the second injury fund, but and I think I understand we're going from $70 to $85 instead of from $70 to $100. But this restoring, the language that's restored, would that retain the present law?
Yeah.
Is that what the restoring does?
Restoring the schedules. The bill, as originally written, was going to substitute the American Medical Association guidelines for the present scheduled and unscheduled portions of the law, and the amendments would delete reference to those guidelines. We'd be back with present law.
It's something that was impossible, Senator Wires, to reach an agreement on.
That particular thing pleases me, and I'm just trying to make sure I understand what's going on.
There are some problems.
But... I'm just trying to get this really fixed in my mind. Then they're just changing the $70 to $85, and that's about all we're doing in that area of partial
second injury.
That and the second
and
injury.
Second injury.
Yeah, on the amendments, lines 13 through 35 on page 2 are restored. All of page 3 is restored, and line 1 of page 4 is restored. That's all would be restoring current law, the current schedule. Then the section on the second injury fund is inserted as a new section of the bill. And then lines 2 through 35 on page 4 are deleted, as well as pages 5 and 6. So that would leave us with the current law with the change to $85 a degree and the new amendment allows front-end incentive out of the second injury fund, which needs to be amended. As
which Keith Wilson is going to have some ideas about how to refine that, but he's basically supportive of that idea. The front-end. Okay, I'm sorry, I need to take that time, but I think I wanted to be real sure I understood. I think I do now. Thank you.
Any further discussion? It's 10:49. We'll put this on as soon as we get together with Keith and Wally. I mean, Senator Carson.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I'd suggest if Keith could just write, have the amendments drawn that he wants, and then...
get together afterwards.
Then once that's done, we can, I'd like Richard to help me.
Sure. Let's turn to Senate Bill 1050. Do you want to take us through that, Rick?
The subcommittee on 1050 adopted a large set of amendments which have been engrossed as Senate Bill, engrossed Senate Bill 1050.
Engrossed 1050 is in the book.
There have been several sets of amendments that have been, since the subcommittee had the bill engrossed for study, have been submitted. We can go over those, I guess, separately. Basically, the bill divides administrative and quasi-judicial duties of the board, which are currently all under the board, into a administrative portion of those duties put under a department and a director, and leaving the board with the quasi-judicial types of duties. It also creates a reconsideration step in the evaluation division so that upon petition, the evaluations division will be able to rehear. The major changes from Senate Bill 1050 is that, as you recall, the bill originally drafted limited the scope of review by the referee to only the record which had been created in the evaluations division. This new section does allow a completely de novo review there. Now, as far as judicial review, it changes quite a bit. It eliminates the circuit court review, and it changes the original 1050 from a de novo review at the circuit court, I mean at the Court of Appeals level, to a substantial evidence review at the Court of Appeals level. This is another major change from the original bill as drafted. The bill also cleans up some problems of authority. It does move the referees under the board, separates them from their funding, for instance, separates them from the directors, since the referees are going to be reviewing decisions made at evaluation level. It was felt that there should be independence of referees should be retained in all cases. I think the major thrust is the judicial review, the restoring of complete de novo review at the referee level, the protection of the independence of the referee, and the division of administrative and quasi-judicial duties into the department headed by administrator for the administrative duties, and the board retains its present authority over the quasi-judicial matters. The board is retained in the review structure. The board does review, under A.M. Gross, does review orders of the referee.
There you go.
Is there no de novo review at the court level?
Not in A.M. Gross, Senate Bill 1050, no. In original 1050, the circuit court was eliminated, but the Court of Appeals was given de novo review.
Why did you take up?
Well, these amendments were basically proposed in a subcommittee meeting in a package, and it's simply one alternative. I think the Compensation Board might want to comment on that. They had a great deal of input into the amendments.
Keith, do you want to come up here and comment?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Wilson, Chairman of Workman's Compensation Board, and I was busy reading the new amendments, which I hadn't seen. Didn't hear Mr. Wyman's comment as to the point that you were interested in.
I think it was in the A.M. Gross Senate Bill 1050, that set of amendments, we eliminate all judicial review except for substantial evidence review at the Court of Appeals level. I think Senator Crowe's question was the policy behind doing away with de novo at a judicial level.
Yeah. Well, the opponents and proponents have pretty well debated that. The board has never taken a hard line in this regard. We are interested in reducing the multiple steps of review and appeal in workman's compensation cases. the various authorities have supported the concept that this process should be an administrative process rather than a judicial process. Of course, the big change was made back in 65 when they departed from the jury trial concept. And since that time, the battle has been raging in every session of the legislature about the further limitation and what steps of the appeal should be cut out. Trial lawyers and others feel very strongly that the board should be out of the review process. Employer groups generally support the concept that the circuit court should be out of the process. We have taken the original 1050 and have done some work on it primarily in an effort to delineate very clearly the respective responsibilities of the new department and the new board as contemplated by this the original draft 1050.
Did Mr. Peterson from the Premier Department, didn't he draft most of the amendments
that
we are here today?
Yes, he did, Senator. That was our main thrust of 1050. We didn't deal much with the philosophical or the substantive provisions of 1050 other than to attempt to clarify it and to make it as clear as we could just how the new structures existing side by side would function and what their responsibilities would be.
Are you satisfied with these amendments the way they're your department?
Yes.
Workers' compensation?
Yes.
Senator Trull?
I'm still wondering now with regard to the court review. We're going to have substantial evidence review. Will we have that at the circuit court
no.
as well? So we are eliminating the circuit court period from everything, right?
Yes.
Okay. Then why not have a de novo review at the appellate court level?
Primarily, Senator Trull, because of the tremendous workload, the workload that would be saddled that the Court of Appeals would be loaded with.
Should that be our concern, the load of the courts, rather than doing the best job for the workers?
No, I think that is your prime concern, the best, accomplishing the best equity and the most.
You would argue then we don't need a de novo review at the court level.
That is my view, because I subscribe to the principle that the evaluation of of disability, that encompasses most of the litigation that we have in workers' compensation. Should be and can be well handled by the administrative process, and that the safeguards of abuse of the guidelines and the law and mistakes of law that the administrative agency makes should be a judicial function.
But there's no way for the courts ever to start over and look at all of the evidence again.
Under this 50A, no. We would not have a de novo review of the fact situation.
I'm sorry. You would have the hearing officers, you'd have the evaluation, C&E, the hearing officers, the board,
then to
on
the court,
that, on your level.
Yeah.
And then directly. Well, let me ask you maybe a question. Is probably I know the answer already. You feel that as far as your experience on the Workers' Compensation Board, and I've known you for many years, Keith, is the workman getting a fair shake, in your opinion, on that level?
My honest belief that he is. I think in recent years the experience at all levels of the board has increased, and the expertise has increased, excepting myself, of course, and that he is getting a fair shake. There are, most of the quarrel, I think, is in the benefit level, whether it be at 75 or 60, or how rich or how lean the benefits are, but I certainly do think
that. Have you seen cases where you felt that the award was not fair, not enough, and you have intervened in this?
Oh, we do that on a daily basis, Senator. That's part of our review process. Yes,
we board member quite closely.
We read verbatim every file that's before us for review. Some of them are very voluminous.
Does all board members read those files?
Two of the three presently are reviewing each file.
How costly is it to that third
step of appeal. I mean, do you have any idea what the costs are taking on the certain part as far as attorney fees are concerned and additional costs?
No, I really don't have.
Would
any
you say it's very costly, or?
Well, of course, the defense of these cases pays the usual attorney's fee for defending the case, appearing at the before the circuit court, making an oral argument generally at the circuit court level. So the insurers are obligated to pay the going rate in every case that's appealed. The claimant's attorney gains nothing at the circuit court level unless he gains something additionally for his client. Then he's paid a percentage of any increase that he gets there. Those attorney fees are controlled by a board-adopted schedule of fees with certain ceilings. We work with the Oregon State Bar Association in adopting those schedules. But what the overall cost is, I don't know. I do not think that the attorney fee impact at the circuit court level is very much.
I see we have a set of amendments. I believe they're proposed by you, which would limit the attorney fees.
Now, these amendments were...
Well, to $50 a...
Yes,
$50 an hour.
First that I've seen these amendments, Mr. Chairman.
You agree with those, with these amendments? Do you think this would affect the quality of attorney that it's difficult for an injured workman to get an attorney that was competent, capable, if you limited them to a measly $50 an hour?
No, I wouldn't. At first blush, I wouldn't think that that would be a handicap.
Whose amendments are these, Mr. Chairman? Whose amendments?
Thank you.
These are submitted by Associated General Contractors.
Redound legal authority. Where'd he go with that Polish buttoning hat on? There he is.
He keeps moving.
I suggested that we amend it on a limitation on lobbyist expenditures for lobbying on workman's compensation matters as well.
Yeah.
It's a new subsection, but
it goes hand in hand.
He didn't show up today with that drafted.
You asked him to draft it?
Yeah, I asked him to draft it for us, but...
You're going to limit lobbying fees to $50 an hour? Is that what you mean? I've never known Jack Kalinowski to spend a nickel. any further questions as far as our Keith is concerned? Do you have any more comments on this,
Keith? Not particularly, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we're interested in seeing that the workman gets a fair shake and that your agency, we'd like to stop one appeals after another, and it seems to me like it's five shots at bucks, dollars is just pretty good odds for...
Well, it's been, of course, you've heard testimony from the opponents and opponents previously in this and other stations, and we're well aware of what the respective arguments are. Both sides are very sincere about their position, but there comes a time, in my view, and as has been mentioned by an appellate judge or two, that this multiple-step appeals process probably is going to have to be done away with. Now, it's your judgment as to whether the board be taken out of the process or the circuit courts shall be taken out, but I strongly support a shortening up of the multiple appeal steps.
Wouldn't that happen with the elimination of the circuit court?
Yes.
Couldn't you still have a de novo review at the appellate court level?
Yes. If the statute, if the law which your 1050A so provided, yes.
And that would streamline it and should lessen the costs and so forth?
Well, of course, the de novo... A review at the Court of Appeals level would further add to the time, to the burden of the courts and to the litigants, I assume, in representing themselves there. Expanding the scope of review at the Court of Appeals level, as contrasted to the present provisions in 1050A, would tend to add more time to the appeals level rather than streamline it. 1050A does streamline the process material.
Mm-hmm.
It, however, in all candor, it should be pointed out that at the evaluation level, with the ability or the provision to reconsider on request new medical information that is developed, that does add, to some extent, the time involved there. But on the other hand, it might very well obviate the necessity or the need for as many hearings. Hopefully, it would. Don't know. It'll remain to be seen.
I wonder if Bob Kennedy, could you come over here? Bob, I'd like to. So you want to wait to stay there, Keith, in case we need you? Bob, I know that you have some reservations about removal of the circuit court.
That's correct.
If we were to go de novo to the Court of Appeals and skip the circuit court,
well,
would this be somewhat better than it?
Well, not the way I see it. Just as Commissioner just stated, that going to the Court of Appeals de novo adds considerable cost. I think there's...
Well, it's considerable cost going to the circuit court, too. I mean, if we leave the circuit court in.
Not as much as I understand it. Now, the legal profession might speak to that point, but I'm under the impression that there's not as much as so as the going to the Court of Appeals. So I'm not an expert on that, so somebody
else...
Do you
have any comment on that?
I think that's true. The process of presenting a case to the Court of Appeals is much more involved and expensive if they are reviewing on a de novo basis. Where all of the exhibits and all of the cases heard all over again.
How many additional cases and I would there be? Would you presume that everyone now that's going to circuit court would take their case to the Court of Appeals if we had de novo at that level?
No, I seriously doubt
it. Would cut it down considerably, would it not?
I would think so. Approximately 290. 333 cases were appealed to the circuit court level. Is that 74 or 75 out of 994 hearings orders that were heard by the hearing officers on or referees on extended disability? I doubt that 290 cases out of that volume would find their way to the Court of Appeals, although I don't really know. It'd be just guessing.
Let me ask you this, Bob. Would you feel more comfortable if we had de novo instead of just on substantial evidence at the, if we decide to eliminate the circuit court at the, if we, at the Court of Appeals level?
Well, I think that the position that I've tried to advance is the most inexpensive way to proceed and still give the injured worker his day in court, shall we say. And quite frankly, the way that we have proposed it, when we're talking about going from the circuit court then to the Court of Appeals on substantial evidence, they were over on the House side, there was an attorney testified over there that was almost 7/8 of a step that was saved. The legal counsel we have has stated that it was way over a half a step, but to be on the safe side, we're calling it a half-step saving. And so the position...
To eliminate the board?
Well, by eliminating the board and then going to, when you go to circuit court de novo, and then going to, if necessary, on up to the Court of Appeals on substantial evidence. And on that substantial evidence, that's the kicker in there. That's where that takes out all the funny business, because not much is going to go there if you don't have anything, any new substantial evidence. So anyway, then going a little bit further while I have the floor is we felt that the board, by giving those people, leaving them to be the administrators, they would then have the time to take care of all the various divisions that are under their jurisdiction at the present time, which I think they are well overloaded with work trying to review cases.
Well, this is Heath Wrightwell at that point. Do you agree with Mr. Kennedy that this would give them more time?
Well, if we didn't have the review process, Mr. Chairman, we would have time to do a lot of things that we don't have the time to do now, that's for sure.
But don't you have an administrator in there now?
Yes, we do.
What's his name?
Chance, R.J. Chance, is a full-time director of the entire Workman's Compensation Board system.
Is he doing a good job?
In our view, he is. He's a long-time employee. He's been with the board since day one, and my view, he is very competent.
Well, if he's doing the job, then why would you have to, why couldn't he take care of this as an administrator, and why do you have to worry about it?
Because
about
present,
this problem?
The statute is presently worded, Mr. Chairman, placed upon the board the responsibility of administering the board function. We do that by delegating and laying policy and giving the director direction that he needs to take and performing ordinary administrative functions, but the responsibility for administration is still the board's and it can't be delegated. So we feel a certain responsibility to be much closer to it under our structure than we would otherwise.
Wouldn't this bill that sets up a board and an administrator take this load off of you, though?
Yes.
And then this would give you more time for review, and
right.
and this would take care of the problem that Mr. Kennedy is alluding to. You'd have the time under the to take care of what you're working on, the reviewing of this of these workman's comp cases.
No, I wasn't talking about them spending their time reviewing. I was talking about them spending their time more in the administrative field and to go up further.
Well, they would have what I'm trying to, maybe I didn't make my point clear. What I meant, they'd have time to take care of these problems that the board doesn't have the time to take care of now under the provisions of this bill.
Well, the thing about this, if there were a director established, then some of these problems wouldn't be theirs any longer. And my position is that you're just adding another layer of bureaucrats by this director. And you know he's going to hire staff, and so we were here to save money, and that's what labor is planning to do without giving the injured worker the short
side. By the board, you're not eliminating anything on that level, any cost on that level. I would, under your proposal.
Well, we see that it would cost us more.
The board is still there.
If our people wanted to have their day in court, we see this as more expensive by going to the Court of Appeal than it would be if we had a day in court in the in circuit court.
Do you have any comments on that statement, Keith? Do you feel it?
No, I really don't. The cost impact, I think, under 1050A and the present system would be, difference would be nominal. We would like to increase the board staff if, as and when that type of structure ever came about. At a certain extent, because we're undermanned now in the review process, even. But, so from that staffing standpoint, I don't think the impact would be very great. As far as the merits of the board being in the appeals process and or the circuit courts, you know, you could discuss that, and it has been discussed endlessly, session after session. And, I don't think I can add anything more to what the already talked about.
Any questions here from any member of the committee? If not, thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Byers?
How many? We just heard testimony for 300 some cases taken to circuit court in a couple of years ago, 74, 75. 50. How many went on to the Court of Appeals that year? Richard, do you know that?
Approximately
51. 51. Well, if we did away, if we had this, the substantial evidence rule in the Court of Appeals, I wonder if there'd be any way to make an educated guess on what that would cut that figure to, that 51 figure.
Yeah, at least one half. We figured out of that 51, 33 of them would not have gotten there.
We might cut it under to under 50, maybe to 30 or something like that. Possible. So are we... It's my impression that part of the argument about this appeal level business is that it isn't the direct costs. It doesn't sound to me like, first, that the cost of 50 cases going to Court of Appeals is a very large part of what's causing all this tremendous inflation. This is a difficult thing for me being a lawyer. I kind of wish I weren't involved in this whole thing because I don't want my self-interest to push me one way or the other, but I'm afraid it will. But it doesn't look to me like that's too much of the cost. But it's part of the argument that part of the a lot of the cost is caused by the claims getting in the recovery increasing as it goes through the different levels, and the people who make the original determination when they hear that the board increased it, and then the circuit court increased it a little more, and then the Court of Appeals increased it a little more, then they start looking over their shoulder and increasing what they give, and there's some kind of a domino effect going on here. Is that one of the arguments?
I think the trial attorneys are quite sure that they're going to get that increase if they take it to a higher court. But the Court of Appeals, as I understand it now, are tough, and the attorneys that take the cases to the Court of Appeals are reluctant to take it there. They're not there to give away the shop.
I wonder how many of those 300 circuit court cases in that period were permanent and total disability, and I wonder how many of those were odd lot.
The chief, can you tell us?
I don't have a statistics, Mr. Chairman, readily available.
Does anybody from SAFE have those statistics?
I think the cases they're involved in.
What about the cases you're involved in? Would you have those? Chuck, they have 60% of the business. I suppose we could.
I don't have the figures, Senator, what
portion goes to online. So that manually look at those.
I wonder if he has an idea of what percentage of the cases that get to the circuit court are permanent and total claims, whether they're, and how many of them are granted there.
Chuck, do you have that? Anyone?
The permanent and total are most of the
what
permanent
percentage
of the, if there, say there are 300 cases in a given year that go to circuit court. We had testimony a couple of years ago. It was in the ballpark of 300. I wonder how many of those cases would have been permanent and total cases, as opposed to permanent partial or something else.
Just a rough estimate, maybe 20 or 30.
Then I wonder what percent of the permanent and totals are granted below the circuit court level.
Rate the funders.
Well, 75% great preponderance. Okay, well,
I guess if you know what percent, Keith, do you have the answer to that? Or
dealing with permanent totals, Mr. Chairman. I have a chart here showing what occurs, and I'll provide the clinic to make a copy of the cases as they go through the field change on extended disability. It doesn't zero in on
some clinic wire. Keith, Chuck, why don't you come up here, and if you have anyone from your department who want up here with you, why, feel free to ask them up. Keith, I think you, perhaps you can come up here, too, and if there are any questions that...
Senator Wires made a statement a minute ago that I think is worth considering is when he talked about domino effect. It might not be the number of cases, but the decisions made at the higher court can certainly come on down and affect the decisions made at the lower level. So it can be a decision of one case kind of verify the odd lot concept, for instance, and then can go back and in fact tells the board, in essence, of certain things that they should make decisions on.
Of course, that's true no matter how many steps you have. That's what the court's supposed to do, isn't it?
That's true, and I suppose the question, or the policy question is accountability. Does the legislature want the accountability of benefits and how they're to be applied to be with the board, who they have direct accountability to in this relationship, or do you want to give it to the courts, where they don't have the accountability, in a sense, to the legislature? And I think that's the policy question that really you have to decide. The board, if they make the final decision, as far as disability is concerned, they come back here every couple of years and they account directly to you about those decisions and what they're based upon. Right now, they're in a very difficult situation because a lot of the decisions they make and decisions you've given to them to make are changed by the court system. And so that's the kind of dilemma we face right now.
Not only is the board are subject to scrutiny, the legislature, the governor, and others as well. And if they are not doing the job, of course, they could be subject to not only severe criticism, but if they're giving away the shop, or if they fail to take proper care of an injured workman, they're subject to criticism. If they don't walk that tight line, I would imagine,
Chairman,
as far as your decisions are concerned. Senator Carson?
I just wonder if I could pursue it. Where are you taking us with this argument? I mean, it seems to me that even we in the legislature are accountable to the judiciary for following the Constitution and due process and a variety of other things. So it's the fact that you're accountable to the court is not troubling you.
Not to the offense of accounting and following the law. But if you're talking about the level
of the lot doctrine, we didn't do.
No, we did.
That's your basic point.
Huh? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And that wouldn't have happened if you had had an appeal on substantial evidence only. Not necessarily. That's true. If that decision was made at the board level, then they would have been accountable.
Well, you find two answers. One, the Supreme Court will make a decision. And two, they'll say this is a legislative matter. Now, you and I won't spend a lot of time, but that decision of whether they render a judgment or leave it to the legislature is theirs to make, and there's not really a common thread, in my view. They'll decide those they think they ought to decide, and they'll refer back to us those they choose not to decide. Where, granted your point, where does that lead us? Are you suggesting that we only let the courts review substantial evidence?
I'm suggesting if you want an administrative system that's directly accountable to the legislature about the determinations and the definitions of the language that you give to them during the course of this process that they're intimately involved in to administer, then I think you want to end the de novo review at the board level. If the interpretation of the language you want established at the higher court, then I think you want de novo at the Court of Appeals.
You think, would you say again, I missed that, it was...
If you want the final determination and accountability with the board that you're setting up as an independent body is what you've done in the first place. You've set them up as an independent body. They have no financial interest in this course. To hear the cases, make the decisions, interpret what the legislature told them to do in the rendering of the benefits, then I think you should stop the de novo appeal at the board level. You have a couple of appeal processes through there. You've given the board on motion also to reconsider. And limit substantial evidence to the Court of Appeals, or whatever court you want to choose. If you want a broader determination by the judicial body, then I would think you'd want de novo review on those consideration of benefits and how they would be applied in the interpretation of language at the Court of Appeals.
Senator Wires? De novo review in the circuit court would seem to be a kind of a safety valve for a person to bring it up if he feels he's been mistreated by the board. Bearing in mind that maybe 75% of the workers in the state do not belong to a union, and I think I'm pretty close to right on that. All right, is there a potential problem of us not hearing about it if we had the no de novo review after the board level? If there were problems developing there, how is our information system going to work here? People don't communicate, often don't communicate well with their legislator. It might sound like an argumentative question. It isn't intended to be. I'm searching here.
I really think there's so many avenues that individuals have of conveying what their concerns are, and certainly the union is one of them. I've never really known a labor representative that on the board, and I know several, and Bill Callahan comes to mind, certainly was responsive to an individual claimant, regardless whether he was a member of the union or not. And it's the very purpose that you have, you know, three people there representing certain elements. They represent workmen, not unions, and represent employers and the general public. And certainly, to be very honest with you, that the board members now and those in the past have never really taken hard lines on labor or management, but have looked on the fairness of the application of the benefits.
I may have conveyed a meaning I didn't intend to. I wasn't intending to say that people who didn't belong to unions might not be getting the same treatment by the board.
No,
you didn't.
Yeah, I understood that. I guess what I was saying is that they look beyond the union and I
assumed that. But what I was just getting at is the only reason I mentioned the union non-union business is that if a person isn't in a union, they might not have as quick access to someone to help them if they felt that they'd gotten the wrong determination. We're trying to get them, we're talking about not having them go to court and have their day in court. Now, what I'm saying is if we do away with their day in court, is there going to be a mechanism to get, you say that the board members reach out, they take a lively interest in each claim sort of thing, and follow up the people?
Yes. I do. I think that they're charged, the hearings officers to begin with, are charged with making sure that workman is properly represented. They do reach out and make sure that he's understanding what he's doing. There's some actual legislation in it. You make decisions in favor, when all things equal, in favor of the workman. And they're charged with that responsibility, and the hearings officers do, and rightly so, protect the workman in the process of the appeals. He does have his day at court. He can set up an independent hearings body that gives him his day in court there. He can appeal to the board, the same entity, a separate body that can consider the evidence again de novo. He certainly has his day in court there. The question is, do you want to give him another day on the same basis or another couple days with the other appeal step?
I'd like to ask Keith a question. Are your hearing officers under the Judicial Fitness Act? I mean,
they're not appointed. The method of removal or disciplining is follows pretty closely judicial fitness.
Same as any judge could be removed.
Yeah. What happens?
Are they under the same commission?
No. We have our own procedure for removing them, but it does make use of the Supreme Court, Circuit Court judges to sit as a panel to consider any complaints that have been lodged against them.
And they maintain their independence, same as a judge. I mean, without the title, but they are judges. And this is something I think the committee should remember. They're not really, their title is hearing officers, but they're still judges.
Well, that's you insisted on keeping them out from under.
I want them to retain their independence, you bet. Now that we're going to eliminate the circuit court, it's all the more important that they retain their independence.
One other element that's, I think, important, and I say this realizing that probably a lot of people might not agree with it, eliminating one step or the other, but what's very important, and this is primarily for the workmen, is to get a final determination as soon as possible. It's so difficult to begin the rehabilitative process while you're hanging over you some final determination of what award you're going to get. The sooner that can be made, however, is important.
This, Senator Wires, I think that's a good point. Would you start that over, Senator Wires?
What I was pointing out, Senator, is that I feel it's extremely important in the process of the rehabilitation process that a final determination is made as soon as possible on the disposition of the case. To prolong that final determination by multiple steps of appeals, if that prolongs it, works diametrically opposed to what you're trying to accomplish is a finality and get on with the rehabilitation process. And there's ability for the board to proceed with the rehabilitation process, but I don't know if you've ever been involved in a court case, and I'm sure you have, but as one who's a defendant or a plaintiff, you know, it's a very traumatic experience. It's an adversary situation, and it's so difficult to get into an attitude of rehabilitation when you're going through that process. It's a frightening experience. Well, I'm sure you realize that for the person you're representing, it's maybe the most traumatic thing that's happened to them is going through a hearing or having your case in court. Most people don't experience that, and it hurts against the process.
Chairman, he's going to testify from my opponent in the trial.
Senator Trevor is going to recognize you. Also, Senator Wires is a well-known basketball player. Played for the Senate.
I hear what you're both saying, and you're talking about wanting the Workmen's Comp Board to be more responsive to the legislature, and you're talking about making the system more accountable. You're talking about the fact that if you prolong the hearings while you're going to create frustration, you're maybe making it more difficult for the person to get back into rehabilitation, perhaps, and at least you're prolonging his period. But we still have to consider equity for the worker, okay? Now, equity for the worker. If there's no chance at all for any kind of complete review of the case, how do we know that through the process of the hearings officers and the board review, we've got people who have looked at evidence in only one way, and maybe a completely new look at that evidence might bring more equity for the worker? How do we know that? 300 times at least in 1 year, this Court of Appeals, or the Circuit Court, decides that workers should have more benefits for whatever reason. No?
Yeah.
Well, what do they decide?
Figures on Circuit Court on extended disability, Senator Troll, indicate that in that fiscal year of 75-76, that of the 290 Circuit Court judgments of 333 cases which were appealed to them, 71% of those affirmed the board decision on extended disability. 15.2% increased the board's award, and 1.4% decreased the board's award, and 12.4% made other dispositions. So 71%.
I don't really see how that's such an expensive process. You're not paying out a lot more money based on that. Where's the cost in having that additional appeal, that de novo review?
The cost can be expressed in maybe a decision of one case.
That's a precedent.
That's a precedent.
Up and down the line.
The cost can be in the what you're doing to the individual while you're dragging them through that horrible process.
But who chooses that? That's his decision.
I think they're, at a certain point in time, they're directed. You kind of turn yourself over
to your counsel. And he's there to, you know, to win the case and to take it through the steps. And so you're giving him to a certain extent to make that choice for you.
And we're satisfied by eliminating both of them, satisfied by eliminating de novo review at the court level, that you're going to provide equity for the workers.
I certainly am, Senator Cho. Otherwise, I wouldn't be, I wouldn't have served on the Workmen's Compensation Board for a week, because I have faith in the people, and I think there are ample safeguards built in to ensure that that occur, not only to the accountability factor that's been mentioned, but another important element that hasn't been mentioned is the board's own motion authority in the case of any person after, or any situation, if he feels that an error has been made, the board has authority to review that any kind of an application. At that point, in the board's own motion proceedings,
is there a danger that you all get locked into your own decisions and not want to contradict your own decisions and change them?
Well, I'm not aware that that's true. You do, of course, have a certain pride in what you're doing and feel that as time goes on and you gain more experience, so you become more capable. But really, the diverse representation on the board, sensitive to the constituency from which they come, particularly in the area of management and labor. Those people, hearing from their constituency all the time, can't get too complacent with what they're doing, or they soon hear about it. And I feel that it's working well. As I want to make very clear that it seems to me that this, it's just you've heard from the experts in the area making their strongest pitch for what the system should be. And I don't want to be in a position of myself of trying to improve on what's already been said before this committee. I think it just comes down to a question of what do you feel comfortable with in doing, if anything, with the present appeals process.
I think Senator Brody, you have any more questions?
No, I'm Mr. Gill to respond to my question.
Mr. Gill?
Mary, I have always felt very strongly, and I testified in 1965, and it was a loan. And I did it after much searching, and certainly don't want to alienate anybody, but I got to be honest. I feel that it's an administrative decision. We have a unique system in the state where we do have an independent body set up. We do have qualified people that have to meet certain criteria to hear cases, and they meet that criteria. We have an appeal step past that to the board that's independent and representative of all parties in the system, and we ought to take advantage of that.
The question, though, was equity to the worker. Do you think there's equity in the system?
The thing that I'm saying is I think that's where the equity is. The extension of litigation in the system is expressed by the developers of this law back 50 years ago. Was the thing that was killing everything was that there was a doggone much litigation. We've got 3,000 cases ourselves backlogged right now in litigation. That's strange when you have an independent body set up to make those kinds of decisions. I think one of the reasons that that's occurring is because of our appeals procedure. I think that's debilitating to the worker. I honestly feel that. And I would like to emphasize the rehabilitation process, not the litigation process, and I think that's where we need to go.
Sure.
Senator Carson?
But with your experience, Chuck, don't you find it also contrary to rehabilitation if the worker feels he got hammered by a policy decision or by an administrative decision? I mean, I hear, and I think you're right, I agree with it, but there's offsetting in part, and that is if the guy feels he got rooked, that as well is hurtful to rehabilitation, isn't it?
Yeah, I certainly feel it is, and I think, you take a look at the win-loss record pass there, and certainly there's more cases affirmed than not at the court level. You still have the ability to go to court to find out if you did get rooked, to find out if they applied the law correctly on substantial evidence, that they are, in fact, taking a look at it from the standpoint of what the legislature told them to do. So you still have that right to go, and the workman really doesn't get into the process too much at that level. It's mostly an attorney process. So he still has an appeal right to the court to make sure the law was applied correctly. I think what you have to say is that, if you're so concerned about the decisions of the administrators, that they aren't proper, or might then you have to do away with the administrative decision and just use the court. If you feel that process is going to be fair, I personally don't think it would be any fair.
Senator Wires? I didn't understand all these cases are backlogged. They only have 300 a year in circuit court. And my other question is, could you give us a little more detail on the business of, which I tend to agree very strongly with you about speeding things up, but could you give us a little more detail about that? How fast from the time a person files his claim until he gets done with the board, how long does that take on the average? As opposed to circuit court on top of it.
It's a long, drawn-out process, anywhere from scoring how many steps he wants to go through. We've got 3,000 cases backlogged at one level or the other, either initial request for hearing or request to the board, request at the circuit court, or request at the Court of Appeals. We never used to have more than a few hundred, and it just keeps growing. I'm not sure exactly why there are so many, and they keep coming in. Those are requests for hearings. The process can take anywhere from several months to a couple of years to get all the way through, going from one step to another.
Well, if we eliminated the de novo review, how long do you think it would take then to get through the hearing?
I mean, if we eliminated the third part, de novo.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a good question.
Well, I don't know. I think you're going to have to give the board the resources they need to hear those cases promptly. And I think with some of the other changes, they're going to be able to make decisions maybe quicker and with more finality. To the extent that it'll lessen the appeals, I'm not sure at this point. But you're going to eliminate a lot of appeals past, of course, the board. On if you just have a substantial evidence rule, you're not going to go through that process. Because obviously they're applying the law as it's supposed to be applied. You're going to cut down probably the numbers along with the time frame considerably, as long as they have the staff to take care of the process. I can't give the exact figures, Senator.
I would think that the legislature itself would be the deterrent to the board to act in any manner that was detrimental to the injured workman or detrimental to the employer interest. And we're back here every 2 years, and if these cases are flagrant, cases are a cause of the attention of the legislature, certainly there'd be action taken, and we could reverse what we have done, what we're about to do here today. So I would think that we also would have a hand in as far as what they're doing and the policy and how they are treating both labor and industry.
Well, it seems like if this is going to be a major thrust of our workman's comp package that we're all working on here, that we ought to really try and nail this down. I don't fault Chuck Gill. I don't think there's any reason why he should have been able to say, well, we'll be able to have it all finished in 6 months or something. But maybe by the time we leave here this session, we should have some kind of a pretty firm figure that we can tell everyone with some realistic hopes of backing it up. Because if that's one of the things that's causing people to slide over from permanent partial to permanent total or odd lot or whatever. I know that's one of our big goals, is to speed up the process.
I would like this known that we are going to have an interim labor committee, and I hope that a number of members of this committee will be on that committee. I know Senator Carson loves it. But I intend to follow up and contact not only the doctors, the insurance companies, the workman's compensation board, and make it almost a full-time. This committee is really going to work and see that the policies are carried out. And instead of just coming up with legislation or ideas, we may get ideas for legislation as far as that. I want to see that the system is working when we're through. And if it's not working, we'll be ready for action the following session. And I want to make sure that the employer and the employee are both treated fairly. And I think this will be the action that I would like to see an interim committee take during the interim period. If the workman's compensation board is having problems with the doctors and they're not sending in the reports, they're operating for a low back injury when they shouldn't have, these are things we're finding out, we want to know. And where those that are ripping off the system, as we're aware of, we want to stop. And I think this is where an interim committee can do the job
Senator Carson?
Could I ask if, in another committee I'm involved in administrative law judges and hearings apart from this, but it does relate to it. It relates to my other question, and either one of you can respond to it, I guess. Isn't there some psychological advantage to having the decision-maker that makes the ultimate decision view the plaintiff? In other words, what I worry about, and I think, Chuck, you alluded to it, by the time it gets up into the rarefied air, whether it's on substantial evidence or just on appeal, the workman is usually sitting back in the audience, if indeed he's even there. Has any thought been given to making the hearings examiner, let's call him as the federal government, an administrative law judge, and pulling him even more away from the workman's comp? And a tax court, if you will. Some states have gone to what's called a labor judge or labor judiciary, and this is the kinds of things that they do, labor relations and so on. Is that a possible alternative? Where I'm coming from is I think a person who's not an agency person ought to sit in front of ought to tell that workman that you're getting a claim or you're not getting a claim. It haunts me that the agency, that if I hear what you're both saying, they're trying to carry out the policies they pursue. I'm not so sure I want the judge carrying out a policy. I want him to read the law and apply it to the facts he sees and reach a decision, and not try to carry out some conservative or liberal policy about how we want to treat workmen. Any thought on that?
Yes, there's been a lot of discussion about that, Senator Carson. As a matter of fact, when the new structure for referees was adopted in 75-73, went into this in considerable depth. And at that time, there was some talk even of making them a workman's compensation court and calling them administrative judges. And of course, we ran head on into all the constitutional questions about elections and terms of office and all that type of thing. But you are correct. There is, as a lawyer myself, I have the same feel that you do, I think, for it. That the board does not, and we very carefully avoid any conversation with referees about policy, about the merits or the theories of law, or anything of that nature. The way we speak to the referees is through the board order. That is part of this independence problem that existed for several years on the board.
Can I interrupt? I think you're doing better than any other agencies. I don't mean to slander the workman's comp, because I think you've led in an independent hearing officer. I'm just not sure you've gone far enough.
We're very sensitive about this.
You've also fought to maintain it, Senator Carson.
That is
independence of the hearing officer.
Yes, I understand.
One of the reasons that we have suggested in 1050A to put the referees under the board's aegis rather than the director, so that they'll not be subject to the administrative whims and controls and through the budget process and the administrative process be influenced in any way, shape, or form. They'll be adjudicators, and while you don't call them judges, that will be in essence what they are. And the only way that the board talks to referees about decisions or about what the law is through the orders that we issue. That isn't to say that we can't properly have seminars and discuss legal theory and things of that nature, but that is what we're trying to do. And I think we've been, as you very graciously have said, I think we've been quite successful in that regard. One of the problems that Chuck mentions about his work, the backlog of cases, comes down purely and simply to a manpower situation. If we had the manpower and a referee corps to handle here twice as many cases as we can now, we could, we could cut down on everybody's workload. But there's a point, limit to how many people you can take on.
You don't have enough budget to hire as many hearings officers as you need?
No, we do not.
Senator Carson, one of the things that the bill does is separate the decision of the initial award. Right now, they make the decision of the award, same body hears it, and the same body hears it again. This bill does separate that initial decision and put the hearings officers in a separate entity, so to speak, to have that independence from those that made the initial award. Your thought, carrying it one step further, has been discussed on a number of occasions of having an administrative hearings division of some kind that is separate and apart altogether. I think that certainly does have merit and is worthy of consideration.
Would it get it? Well, you've answered it. I hope we try it not in workman's comp. I think we've let them out, but in some of the areas, in fact, that's where I have to go right now.
Stick around a little bit here. We'll be through in a minute.
Tom, did you stay there if there are any other questions? Tom, did you have something you want to say? Just stand and stay right. It's Tom Murphy, a trial attorney.
Yes, sir. I'd like to refer to page 21 of the gross case. It says the board shall be charged with providing general guidelines for the evaluation of permanent disabilities. Number one, I remember that testimony in here before that rephrased Keith Wilson, he says the person that has the last de novo review has the hammer. That isn't exactly the language he used. He's more subtle, but it's got
what line did he say? What line?
Page,
what line is that on?
Page 34.
29 on.
34?
Page 21, line 34.
Oh.
Is that language not broad enough?
Are you on that A engrossed?
A engrossed. Senate Bill.
Page 21, line 34?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Providing general guidelines for evaluation of
permanent
disability. Is that language not broad enough so that the board could, if it wanted to, adopt the AMA guide and tell the hearings officers to apply it?
Keith, do you want to answer that?
I perfectly, frankly think that it could be interpreted this way, and this is one of the points that I have.
Well, I think
maybe it could be interpreted that way, but I think you have people that are fair in that department. I suppose they can interpret a law anyway. It depends on the person administering that law.
The present
I would
board.
Imagine.
No criticism of the present board.
Okay.
I mean, past board, and there are future boards.
You want to comment on that, Keith?
One of the criticisms that has been leveled at the board in recent months and years is that the board has knuckled under and caved in to the court system, and that it's a court-administered system now. Our response to that is that the court, having the last say in these matters, has the last say in construing the law, and thereafter, the board is bound to follow it, because that's the law once the courts establish it. What I think this language is an attempt to do is to instruct and mandate the board to establish methods of rating disability, and to instruct the evaluation division and the hearing to construe the law and to establish guidelines. And I'd have to agree with my friend Mr. Murphy that conceivably it could go that far. I'm not sure that would be the decision, but if the board is given that authority, that's precisely what it would do, is establish some kind of guidelines where everybody would be bound by them.
Does Mr. Murphy, do you feel that the court should provide the general guidelines for the evaluation of a permanent disability? Sir, the court should do that?
I think, Your Honor, that this language could have them say we only consider impairment, that we do not consider the background and the training and the education of the individual. I think this language could be construed almost any way that it wants to be construed by the body involved. And that's why I think it's that broad.
Hey, I'm going to ask a friend of mine that has been with the Workman's Compensation Board, Cliff Allison. What is your answer to that?
I think Mr. Murphy is in error. The only guidelines that we can establish is in the existing framework of the statute. Let the legislature be delegated to us. We can't amend the statute. At the present time, the only guideline or criteria for determining unscheduled is loss of earnings capacity. We could not amend that statute by this rule.
That's not in the statute.
However, it's been interpreted. The law has been interpreted. The statute has been interpreted. And if you're going to change the interpretation, you can't change it by an administrative rule. You've got to change it by legislation. We cannot amend statutes by rule.
Well, I mean, you can't change case law. Is what you meant to say, that last sentence? We cannot change. Just a minute now. Let me ask my question. You can't change case law precedent through administrative rule?
That is correct.
That's what you're saying.
Our rule would be invalid if we adopted a rule that's contrary to law.
Right. So the case law.
You've got the case law.
Thank you. Is that what you want to say?
No, I have not.
Okay.
On the case you just brought up, Mr. Murphy, you're alluding to a situation where the board, let's say, would by rule do away with the section of the statute that talks about what a suitable occupation is, age, training, experience, and so forth. Well, are you saying that could not be reviewed by a court under substantial evidence?
That could be reviewed by a court of
appeals. Well, no one has talked in this hearing about doing away with ultimate court of appeals substantial evidence review. So, in some sense, your problem is already taken care of. In that case, because I think that's a matter of law, clearly. It's not a matter of benefit award in terms of amount, but that kind of question could be reviewed, I think, by the court of appeals under substantial evidence, I would think.
Well, let's put it this way. I can think of another phrase in here where we have only in the scheduled areas where the board can only say we only consider specifically the range of motion that a person has in his arm or his elbow or whatever you're talking about like that. We could not consider the pain aspect of it. We adopt the AMA guide for that. There's no case law on that, and it's potentially something that could be misused. I'm saying.
And not reviewed under substantial evidence.
Not reviewed under substantial evidence.
Any further discussion? If not, what is your pleasure as far as the amendments are concerned? The Senate bill, 1050. I'm not alluding to the AGC amendments at this time.
Of course, the entire Eden Grove Senate Bill 1050 has not been adopted. That is, that was printed for study only.
Yeah.
So those amendments would need to be adopted if we were going to...
The amendments that are here are...
That are engrossed in Eden Grove 1050 have not been adopted. They
are, these are the amendments, however, that were in... dated 5-4, are in the bill, are engrossed in the bill now. Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't have to adopt the amendments. The bill is before us for this purpose, so we can see it as it is, the proposed amendments.
And what you really want to know is how do we want to act on eliminating the circuit court,
right,
and having the substantial evidence only reviewed by the Court of Appeals.
Right.
Is there any other question any substantive question in these amendments other than that?
Well, you create a department where there has not been one to this date. You create an department and administrator to handle administrative functions.
Oh, that's in here too.
Yeah. It does provide for a full de novo review by the referee, which is a change from the original 1050, which had a on-the-record review. Of course, that's back to present policy. Presently, there's a full referee review.
What's the pleasure of the committee? Forever speak now or forever hold your peace. You want to take action on it today, or would you like to be lobbied some more?
Can I answer no to both questions? Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll just have to put my foot in. I don't think I'm ready to vote aye on any of these at this moment, and it's more out of ignorance than out of any deep philosophical objection to it.
Any other
comments before, by the way? I felt kind of bad.
The amendments that are dated 5-4 were not discussed today. They basically take the board out and put the circuit court back in.
Okay. So we're just talking about 1050, and 1050 has gone through the engrossed period without...
1050, A and Gross...
What's before? What would be an appropriate motion? To send it out before...
To pass the amendments as per A and Gross Senate Bill 1050.
As it's now engrossed.
It's been engrossed only for study. It's been printed for your convenience.
There's no amendments to it.
No, there are no amendments that have been adopted to the original Senate Bill 1050. A and Gross 1050 is for study only. It was printed for study, not... It's had no vote on it at all.
Hmm.
Are there wires?
Well, I'll... As far as I'm going to go is to say that I am right on the edge of being in favor of doing away with the circuit court, but I'm not about to make any such motion.
Okay. Senator Trowe? Do you want to take the gavel and want me to make the motion?
You can't make the motion. Something unheard of for you to make a motion.
Well, I would move we adopt amendments to Senate Bill 1050 that are engrossed in Senate Bill 1050, A engrossed. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
No.
Senator Hannon?
Aye.
Senator Trowe?
Aye.
Senator Wires?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion has failed. Let's go to...
Here we go.
Senate Bill 796.
Oh.
796 will not be on the agenda today because the blind have withdrawn
this particular bill, and they prefer waiting another 2 years before they make any decision.
You assigned 474 to me. I think Senator Carson would like. He'd moved it.
Okay, fine. Put Carson on it.
Do we
what? Yeah. I think that 27-28...
You want to carry that over then?
We'll carry that over. Oregon. 27-28, I see that the witnesses for that are people that are here. Stan Bunn?
I think it's his AA, I think.
I see. Ed, well, they're all here. So let's put 27-28 over to our next work session, if that's agreeable. Friday. And we are adjourned.
Well, you brought it down to the wire. Everybody's standing accounted for.